July 24th, 1997, Fremont County, Wyoming. After spending the day running errands, 24-year-old Amy Rowe Bechtel never returns home, and her abandoned car is discovered on a remote road in Shoshone National Forest. Even though he claims to have an alibi, Amy's husband, Steve Bechtel, is looked at as a potential suspect by law enforcement due to his unwillingness to take a polygraph test. However, the investigation eventually focuses on convicted murderer Dale Wayne Eaton, who was supposedly in the area when Amy went missing, but there is no evidence to implicate him, and no trace of Amy is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering one of our most highly requested missing persons cases, the 1997 disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel. Anyway, the disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel is a very prominent missing persons case which has been featured on Unsolved Mysteries and Disappeared, and not surprisingly, I've had numerous requests to cover it since the inception of this podcast. It involves a young woman who went missing in Shoshone National Forest after apparently driving out there to go running, and while her abandoned car was discovered on a remote road, Amy herself could not be found. At the outset, there was speculation that Amy may have gotten lost and succumbed to the elements, or been attacked by a wild animal, but investigators soon directed suspicion towards her husband, Steve Bechtel. While there was virtually no evidence against Steve, and he seemed to have an alibi during the time period Amy went missing, he raised some eyebrows by declining to take a polygraph test and ceasing communication with law enforcement. As the years have gone by, it seems like there has been more focus on the theory that Amy crossed paths with a predator who wound up killing her. The most promising potential suspect is Dale Wayne Eaton, who is currently incarcerated for the murder of Lisa Marie Kimmel, another case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. However, even though Eaton was reportedly camping in Shoshone National Forest on the day Amy vanished, no direct evidence has ever linked him to this case, and he has always refused to speak with investigators. It has now been 26 years since Amy went missing, so on this episode, we're going to explore all the different scenarios about what may have happened to her. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel. Our story begins in Wyoming in 1997, and our central figure is 25-year-old Amy Rowe Bechtel, who currently lives with her 27-year-old husband, Steve Bechtel. Amy was originally born in Santa Barbara, California to parents Duane and Joanne Rowe, and was the youngest of their four children. Shortly after Amy's birth, the Rowe family relocated to Wyoming, and Amy grew up in the towns of Jackson and Douglas. She wound up attending the University of Wyoming in Laramie, which is where she met Steve Bechtel, who originally hailed from Casper. They both majored in exercise physiology, and after living together for 4 years, they finally married in June of 1996. While attending university, Amy was a competitive long-distance runner who won a number of races, and after competing in the Boston Marathon in 1996, she is hoping to try out for the women's marathon at the 2000 Summer Olympics. At this particular point, Amy and Steve are residing in Lander, a town located in Fremont County which has a population of just over 7,000 people. Steve is an avid rock climber and had decided to move to Lander because it was near the Black Hills mountain range, which contains a lot of limestone that is ideal for climbing. The Bechdels live in one of 12 rental cottages located on Lucky Lane in a section nicknamed Climber's Row, since a number of competitive rock climbers and athletes reside there. Steve is the assistant manager of an equipment store named Wild Iris Mountain Sports, which is owned by his neighbor Todd Skinner, another rock climber who happens to own the rental cottage where the Bechdels live. Amy also works part-time at the store, and holds down other part-time jobs working as a waitress at the Sweetwater Grill, teaching a youth weightlifting class at the Wind River Fitness Center, and being an amateur photographer whose pictures are sometimes published in the local newspaper, the Lander Journal. The Bechdels had always hoped to move out of the rental cottage on Climber's Row, and on July the 21st, they finally closed on the purchase of a new house. 3 days later, on July the 24th, Steve had the day off from work, so he was planning to travel 75 miles to the town of Dubois to meet up with a travel writer friend of his named Sam Leitner in order to scout some rock climbing locations. Steve was also planning to bring along the couple's yellow Labrador retriever, Johns. According to Steve, Amy told him that after teaching her youth weightlifting class at the fitness center during the morning, she was going to spend the rest of the day running errands and preparing for their upcoming move to their new house. Steve then left the residence at 9:30 a.m., and he has always maintained that this was the last time he ever saw his wife. Now, it was established that Amy taught her weightlifting class that morning, and during the afternoon, she stopped at a pair of photo stores named Camera Connection and Gallery 331. According to the owner of Gallery 331, Amy checked her watch a few times during their conversation and left at around 2:30 p.m. The owners of both these establishments would later recall that Amy was dressed in a yellow tank top, black shorts, and sneakers, as if she was planning to go running. At 4:30, Steve said that he returned home from his trip to Dubois with his dog Johns, but Amy was not there. A friend of the Bechdels would drop by the residence at around 6:45 and invite Steve to join a group of their friends for pizza, but since Amy had still not returned yet, Steve declined. At 8:15, he went to visit his neighbor, Todd Skinner, and Todd's wife, Amy Whistler Skinner, and to avoid confusing her with Amy Rowe Bechdel, I'm now going to be referring to Amy Whistler Skinner as Amy S. Todd and Amy S. had also not seen Amy, and were planning to go out to a screening of the movie Con Air, but while they invited Steve to join them, he once again said that he wanted to stay home until Amy came back. Amy had originally planned to spend the day traveling to the town of Powell in order to visit her parents Duane and Joanne, and pick up some furniture from them for her new house, but she decided against it since she had too many things to do that day. When Amy failed to resurface by 9 p.m., Steve phoned the Rows to check if Amy had decided to go visit them after all, but her parents had also not heard from her. Finally, by 10:30, Amy had still not returned home, so Steve decided to call the Fremont County Sheriff's Office in order to report her missing. A section of the audio from Steve's phone call has been released publicly, and it has always been the center of controversy, as he jokingly said, quote, "Hi, this is Steve Bechdel calling. I'm missing a person, and I was wondering if maybe you had an extra," end quote. Regardless, a pair of deputies came to visit Steve and told him that they were going to organize a search and rescue team to look for Amy if she did not return by morning. Todd and Amy S. returned home from the movies at 11 p.m., and when Steve told them that he had reported his wife missing, the Skinners volunteered to go out and search some roads where Amy was known to go jogging. In response, Steve told them he would remain at the residence in case Amy attempted to call him. For the next 2 hours, the Skinners drove around searching for Amy and eventually headed down Loop Road, which ran through Shoshone National Forest near the Wind River Range of the Rocky Mountains. In September, Amy was planning to participate in a 10K run which was organized by the Wind River Fitness Center and would take place on Loop Road before it ended at Fry Lake. Well, at around 1 a.m. on the morning of July the 25th, the Skinners arrived at Burnt Gulch, a turnoff located a half mile away from Fry Lake, and they came across Amy's abandoned white Toyota Tercel. This location was about 15 miles southwest of Lander, and the Tercel was unlocked and its keys were resting on the driver's seat. A number of Amy's personal items were still inside the vehicle, including her $120 sunglasses and a to-do list for the errand she had been running that day. And the only item which appeared to be missing was Amy's green Eagle Creek wallet. Some of the items on Amy's to-do list had been checked off, which included turning on the phone and electric services of her newly purchased house, dropping off items from her fitness center at the local recycling center, and visiting the photo stores. An item at the bottom of the list which wasn't checked off was run, but Amy had scribbled down some landmarks from the area and readings from her odometer, which seemed to indicate that she traveled to the area to scout the route on Loop Road for the upcoming 10K run. Todd used his cell phone to call Steve and inform him about the discovery of Amy's car, and Steve quickly drove to the area to search the forest for Amy alongside the Skinners and some of their other friends. Since they initially believed that Amy may have simply gotten lost or injured and did not suspect foul play, no attempt was made to preserve the spot where her car was found as a potential crime scene. In fact, the Skinners would later drive Amy's vehicle home before it could be processed by law enforcement for evidence. It wasn't long before an extensive search effort was performed in the area by over 500 people, which included law enforcement, volunteers, and Amy's friends and family. It would be conducted over a radius of more than 20 miles, and various lakes and mines were checked, but after 8 days, the search effort had failed to turn up Amy or any real evidence at all, so it was called off. The most promising lead was provided by a couple named Jim and Wendy Gibson, who claimed they had been driving through the area at around 5 p.m. on July the 24th and saw a blonde woman in dark shorts matching Amy's description running along Loop Road. The Gibsons later headed back down the road in the opposite direction, and while they did not see the woman again, they did recall seeing what they described as a quote-unquote dirty white vehicle at Burnt Gulch. This was likely Amy's Toyota Tercel, and Wendy even said that she saw what she described as quote-unquote something red through the vehicle's rear window. The Gibsons also reported that when they drove further down the road, they noticed a shirtless man with a plastic container standing outside a gray truck with half a load of logs, but I'm not sure if this man was ever identified or if the sighting has any relevance to the case. But later that same evening, eyewitnesses reported hearing gunfire at Lewis Lake, located about 8 miles from Burnt Gulch, along with someone yelling, quote, "Come on, you sissy, do it, do it." The Fremont County Sheriff's Office would bring in the FBI to assist them with the investigation, and on August the 5th, 12 days after Amy went missing, Steve was brought in to be interviewed. He was here when one of the FBI agents said to him, quote, "I have evidence that proves you killed Amy, and we would like to have you take a polygraph test right now to prove that you didn't," end quote. Well, this prompted Steve to terminate the interview and walk out, and he soon retained the services of a defense attorney named Kent Spence. Steve soon informed law enforcement that all further communication with him would be done through his attorney, and that on the advice of counsel, he was not going to take a polygraph. The lead investigator for the Fremont County Sheriff's Office was Sheriff's Deputy Dave King, who was actually away on a trip to the mountains at the time Amy went missing, and did not take over the investigation until 1 week later. The authorities initially speculated that Amy may have gotten lost in Shoshone National Forest and succumbed to the elements, or was attacked by a wild animal, such as a bear or a mountain lion. But the main reason King started becoming suspicious of Steve is because of an eyewitness sighting from a camper who reported seeing a blue pickup truck speeding down Loop Road sometime between 4:30 and 5 p.m. on July the 24th. The camper said that an unidentified man was at the wheel and a blonde woman was in the passenger seat, and Steve drove a blue pickup which just happened to match this truck's description. However, the issue is that phone records showed that Steve had called a friend of his from his residence at 4:43 p.m. that day and left a message on his answering machine. This seemed to corroborate Steve's story that he arrived home from Du Bois at 4:30 and would have made it impossible for him to be driving his pickup truck on Loop Road during the time frame of this eyewitness sighting. Regardless, the day after Steve terminated his interview, the Fremont County Sheriff's Office got a warrant to perform a search of his residence and his truck. They claim this was mostly done to obtain items containing samples of Amy's DNA for a possible future comparison, but after impounding and searching Steve's truck, Dave King told the press, quote, "There was some questionable substance found in the truck, biological things, but we don't know the conclusion on that. I don't think the jury is back yet," end quote. But investigators were particularly troubled by a series of journals which they obtained during their search of the Bechtel residence. The journals were penned by Steve, and while very few details about them have been released publicly, they supposedly contain numerous poems and writings with descriptions of violence towards Amy and other women, and Steve expressing a desire for power and control. For his part, Steve claimed that many of these passages were written back when he was in high school, and some of them were nothing more than song lyrics he had written for his band. But the writings raised alarm bells with Amy's brother, Nels Rowe, as well as Nels' wife, Teresa, who happened to be the director of a center for domestic abuse victims. Nels and Teresa claimed that a few weeks before Amy went missing, they invited her and Steve over for dinner and noticed a suspicious bruise on Amy's arm. When Nels asked about the bruise, Amy simply responded that Steve could, quote-unquote, get a little rough sometimes, and Steve followed this up by proceeding to place his hands on Amy's shoulders. While Nels and Teresa acknowledged that Amy did not look overly concerned when she said this, they wondered if Steve might have been abusive. Indeed, the Rowe family felt that Steve appeared to be jealous, controlling, and possessive towards Amy, and that she seemed to change her demeanor whenever her husband was around her. For their part, the Skinners, as well as many other friends of the Bechtels, claimed they did not notice any signs of abuse or friction within the couple's marriage, and believed that Steve's writings were taken out of context and had no connection to Amy's disappearance. Steve was also very active in the search effort for his wife, as he established the Amy Rowe Bechtel Recovery Headquarters, which launched a new website and hotline for tips and would circulate around 250,000 missing persons flyers. On September the 28th, the 10K run which Amy had been planning to compete in was finally held on Loop Road in order to raise money for the search fund, and the event would be named the Amy Bechtel Hill Climb. Steve continued to maintain that he had an alibi, placing him 75 miles away in Du Bois on the afternoon Amy went missing. As you recall, Steve said that he met a friend of his named Sam Leitner in order to scout locations for rock climbing, but since the weather turned out to be poor, the two men went their separate ways and left Du Bois earlier than they had planned, sometime between 3 and 3:30 p.m. But while investigators uncovered a receipt which showed that Sam purchased gas in Du Bois that afternoon, they could not find any hard evidence placing Steve in the area during that time period. Even though Steve claimed that he had purchased a hammer at a hardware store in Du Bois, he did not hold on to the receipt for it, and there were no other independent eyewitnesses who could corroborate having seen Steve and Sam together. However, it's worth noting that Sam had previously gone on a trip to Australia with the Bechtels, but had issues getting along with Steve and decided to fly home early. It sounds like the two men still kept in touch in order to scout rock climbing expeditions, but were not particularly close friends, and Sam later said, quote, "I actually got along with Amy better than I did with Steve in Australia. I'm not going to cover for somebody who might have murdered a friend of mine," end quote. Law enforcement told the media that they did not actually consider Steve to be a suspect, as they only wanted to clear him of any involvement in order to pursue other leads, which is why they wanted him to agree to a polygraph. In the months following Amy's disappearance, her brother Nels and her parents had also expressed their desire for Steve to take a polygraph, but Amy's two sisters, Casey Lee and Jenny Newton, continued to publicly support him. However, in February of 1998, the case would be featured on an episode of the Geraldo Rivera Show with appearances by Steve, Casey, Jenny, and Dave King. This time, the two sisters pleaded with Steve to share information about Amy's disappearance, and even Geraldo implored him to take a polygraph, but Steve maintained that he had already shared everything he knew and denied any involvement. Well, around the time the Geraldo episode aired, investigators were exploring another lead involving a man named Kelly McLeod, who had apparently become infatuated with Amy back when she was working as a waitress at a coffee shop during her time at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Amy had gotten McLeod interested in running, and he even competed in a few races, but she would later say his obsession with her made her uncomfortable. What Amy did not realize at the time was that McLeod had been a wanted fugitive since 1988, as he had illegally taken custody of his one-year-old daughter from his ex-wife and fled New York State with her, violating a court order. McLeod was also charged and convicted of raping a teenager in Kentucky in 1990, but jumped bail while awaiting sentencing and fled the state with his daughter. Naturally, investigators wanted to find McLeod and question him about his potential involvement in Amy's disappearance, and he was finally tracked down and arrested in Medford, Oregon in February of 1998. McLeod's daughter, who was now 11 years old, was returned to the custody of her mother, but he was soon cleared of any involvement in Amy's case, as McLeod was able to provide evidence that he was on the East Coast on the date she went missing. But curiously, Dave King made this cryptic statement to the press, quote, "McLeod offered valuable information to us of a personal nature about Amy and about Amy and Steve's relationship. We didn't hear anything unexpected," end quote. During this same time period, the FBI felt that they might have received a lucky break in the investigation, as it turned out that the Russian space station, Mir, was hovering directly over Fremont County and had taken satellite photos of the area on the date Amy disappeared. The FBI managed to obtain these photos, but they turned out to be a dead end, as Amy had gone missing on an overcast day, so the photos were obscured by clouds. The case would receive even more national attention when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in April of 1999, and Steve once again appeared on camera to defend himself. Dave King, who had since been elected to Fremont County Sheriff, was also interviewed on the show and continued to cast suspicion on Steve for his unwillingness to take a polygraph. Well, a year and a half later, in November of 2000, King would find himself embroiled in his own scandal when he abruptly resigned as sheriff, as it turned out that he had a serious drug and alcohol problem and had stolen cocaine from his department's evidence locker. He eventually pled guilty to the charges of unlawfully obtaining cocaine and using cocaine and received a 3-year suspended sentence and probation. In January of 2001, the Rowe family would suffer an additional tragedy when Amy's father, Dwayne Rowe, passed away at the age of 71. Another interesting development took place in June of 2000 when a man hiking near the Middle Fork Popo Agee River came across a Timex Iron Man digital wristwatch which was no longer functional and missing its band. Amy had been wearing a wristwatch like that on the day she went missing, and even though this item was found in the same area where she vanished, it could not be conclusively established if this watch belonged to her. A set of bones were also found near the watch, though they were later determined to belong to an animal. 1 year later, in June of 2004, Steve finally had Amy declared legally dead, a decision which the Rowe family did not agree with, since there was no conclusive proof that Amy was not alive. Shortly thereafter, Steve got remarried to another woman, and while he attempted to relocate to Salt Lake City, Utah at one point, Steve ultimately decided to return to Lander, where he continues to reside to this day with his wife and their 2 children. Over the next few years, law enforcement would continue to publicly express their suspicions about Steve. In July of 2005, on the 8-year anniversary of Amy's disappearance, Fremont County Sheriff Larry Matthews stated, quote, "In my opinion, Steve was the only suspect when she disappeared, and Steve is the only suspect now. There are no other suspects who had the motive or the opportunity," end quote. 2 years later, the new lead investigator, Detective Sergeant Roger Reiser, spoke about the case with the Billings Gazette and expressed his belief that Amy's death was a homicide, stating, quote, "In my mind, there is only one person that I want to talk to, only one person who has refused to talk to law enforcement, and that's her husband," end quote. However, by 2010, Fremont County Patrol Sergeant John Zurga had taken over as lead investigator, and he started exploring other leads which did not involve Steve Bechtel. The case would be featured on an episode of Disappeared, which aired in January of 2013, but while Steve declined to be interviewed on the show, Zurga confirmed that Steve had recently agreed to speak with him and was starting to cooperate with law enforcement again. An alternate theory which was explored on the Disappeared episode was a local rumor involving a group of Native Americans who lived on the Wind River Reservation which ran through both Fremont and Hot Springs counties. The story goes that these individuals had been drinking on the day of Amy's disappearance and accidentally struck her with their vehicle before burying her body in a shallow grave. This rumor always mentioned a specific vehicle, so the Fremont County Sheriff's Office secured permission from the tribal police to process this vehicle for evidence, but they found nothing, and the allegations about Amy being the victim of a hit-and-run remain unsubstantiated. However, the most prominent theory which has emerged since John Zurga took over the investigation is the potential involvement of a suspect named Dale Wayne Eaton, who was responsible for the murder of another victim featured on Unsolved Mysteries. The victim in question was 18-year-old Lisa Marie Kimmel, and her case would be known as the Lil Miss Murder, as Lil Miss was written on the vanity license plate on the vehicle Lisa was driving at the time she was killed. On March 25, 1988, Lisa left her home in Denver, Colorado, in order to make a lengthy drive to Cody, Wyoming, where she would pick up her boyfriend and then go to visit her family in Montana. Well, Lisa never arrived at her boyfriend's residence and was reported missing, and 8 days later, her body was discovered in the North Platte River near Casper. She had been bound, beaten, and raped before she was hit in the head with a blunt object and stabbed 6 times, and the autopsy indicated that she had been held in captivity for days before she was killed. But curiously, Lisa's Honda CRX, containing her Lil Miss license plate, could still not be found anywhere. The case would remain unsolved until 2002, when DNA testing linked semen found in Lisa's body to a career criminal named Dale Wayne Eaton, who was incarcerated at a federal prison in Littleton, Colorado. In September of 1997, Eaton had kidnapped a couple named Scott and Shannon Breeden, as well as their 5-month-old son, at gunpoint, after their van broke down on Interstate 80 in Sweetwater County, Wyoming, and Eaton pulled over in his green 1985 Dodge van to offer them a ride. But the Breeden soon managed to overpower Eaton and escape from him, and after they contacted the authorities, Eaton was tracked down and arrested. Even though Eaton was charged with attempted kidnapping, there was a major issue with prison overcrowding in Wyoming at that time, so Eaton agreed to a plea deal in which he would only serve 99 days in jail before he was released on probation and move into a halfway house in Casper. However, when Eaton broke his probation, a warrant was issued for his arrest, and he was tracked down in July of 1998. Since Eaton had a shotgun in his van when he was taken into custody, he was hit with federal weapons charges and forced to submit a sample of his DNA, which would later be matched to evidence from the Lisa Marie Kimmel case. He was subsequently charged with a number of different crimes, including first-degree premeditated murder, aggravated kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and first-degree sexual assault. Back in 1988, Eaton had been living inside a converted school bus on his property in the unincorporated community of Moneta, Wyoming. After abducting Lisa from a remote rest area, Eaton held her captive in this school bus for days and raped her several times before he killed Lisa and dumped her body off a bridge into the North Platte River. At the time, Eaton's neighbors recalled him digging a large hole on his property, and when the authorities went there to perform an excavation in 2002, they wound up finding Lisa's missing Honda CRX, complete with the Little Miss license plate. In March of 2004, Eaton went on trial for Lisa's murder, and after being found guilty on all charges, he received the death penalty. However, he eventually received a stay of execution, and after his death sentence was overturned, Eaton was removed from death row and formally resentenced to life imprisonment without parole or commutation on the first-degree murder charge, with additional sentences on the charges of felony murder, aggravated kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and first-degree sexual assault. At the time of this recording, Eaton is currently 78 years old and remains incarcerated at the Wyoming Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington. Well, even though Eaton has only been conclusively linked to Lisa Marie Kimmel's murder, there has always been speculation that he might be a serial killer who is responsible for murdering additional victims. This includes a series of crimes known as the Great Basin Murders, in which at least 9 women were killed within the Great Basin geographical area of Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and Nevada between 1983 and 1997. I'll go into more details about these crimes later on in this episode, but Eaton has also been looked at as a potential suspect in the disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel. Following Eaton's arrest in July of 1998, his brother, Richard Eaton, had sent in a tip to the Fremont County Sheriff's Office about Dale's possible involvement in this case. Richard told the lead investigator at the time, Roger Reisor, that his brother often liked to travel to Fremont County in order to go camping in Shoshone National Forest near Burnt Gulch, as it was apparently a good spot for trout fishing and elk hunting. Richard believed that Dale may have traveled there in July of 1997, on the date when Amy went missing, but Reisor apparently dismissed this tip, since Dale's niece had told him he was visiting her in Greeley, Colorado on July the 24th. However, by the time John Zerga took over the investigation in 2010, Dale had been charged and convicted of murder, so Zerga decided to take a fresh look at Richard's tip. When Richard was able to provide a number of specific geographic details about the Burnt Gulch area, Zerga became convinced that Dale had been there at some point, but when he attempted to formally interview Dale about the case in prison, Dale refused to speak with him. Thus far, no evidence has ever been found to link Eaton with Amy's case, but Zerga seems to think he is a much more promising suspect than Steve Bechtel. But after 26 years, there are no conclusive answers about what happened, and Amy Rowe Bechtel continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is yet another frightening missing persons case in which the victim just seemingly vanished into thin air, and there's virtually no evidence to work with. If you search online discussions about the case, it seems like the two most prominent theories are that Amy Rowe Bechtel was either killed by her husband or fell prey to a predator like Dale Wayne Eaton. But even though an extensive search effort failed to find her, Amy did go missing in a remote forest area, so I guess you can't completely rule out the possibility that Amy died of exposure or was killed by a wild animal, and her remains were simply missed by the searchers. After all, there is technically no direct evidence that foul play took place. However, it's been theorized that the lack of evidence is the main reason that law enforcement wound up directing suspicion towards Steve Bechtel in the first place. At one point, Steve's attorney, Kent Spence, told the media, quote, "The FBI, in their usual sensitive manner, attacked Steve Bechtel when they became frustrated with their failure to come up with any clues. They pointed their cannons at him and accused him of being involved when they had no evidence whatsoever." End quote. Indeed, I've seen a lot of unsolved missing persons cases in which there is definitely good reason to suspect the victim's spouse, but when you look at the timeline of events, it appears that law enforcement was forced to do some major reaching in order to pin this crime on Steve. As the years have gone by, there has been criticism that the original investigators developed tunnel vision and became so hung up on the idea of Steve being the perpetrator that they may have overlooked other leads, including a fairly intriguing tip from Dale Wayne Eaton's brother. It's interesting to watch the progression of this case over the past 26 years, as most of the earliest media coverage directed suspicion towards Steve, not because there was any real evidence against him, but due to his perceived lack of cooperation with the authorities and unwillingness to take a polygraph test. If you watch the original Unsolved Mysteries segment about this case from 1999, you'll see very divided opinions about Steve, though it is interesting to note that the most outspoken person against him, lead investigator Dave King, would soon find himself in serious legal trouble for stealing cocaine. By the time Amy's episode was featured on Disappeared in 2013, Steve had elected to stop giving interviews about the case, but the lead investigator at that time, John Zerga, painted Steve in a much more favorable light, and while he had not completely ruled him out as a suspect, you get the impression that Zerga did not believe that Steve was responsible. In spite of this, the Disappeared episode featured interviews with Amy's brother, Nels Rowe, as well as her mother, Joanne Rowe, who both expressed their own suspicions and frustrations with Steve. Hell, Dave King was interviewed on the show, and even though he had not worked on the investigation in quite some time for obvious reasons, he still seemed to have his own biases and was unwilling to let go of the possibility that Steve killed Amy. So the first thing about Steve which struck everyone as weird was when he first phoned the police to report Amy missing and made this sarcastic comment, quote, I'm missing a person, and I was wondering if maybe you had an extra, end quote. While that is admittedly an unusual thing to say under those circumstances, different people will respond to stressful situations in different ways, and sometimes they will use humor to deal with it. You also have to take into account that Amy had only been missing for a couple of hours at this point, and her abandoned car was not yet found. While Steve was still concerned about the fact that Amy had not returned home, he had not yet reached full panic mode, and he may have hoped that Amy would turn up soon, and he'd realize that this whole silly call to the police was just an overreaction. I think it's also worth mentioning that the full audio of Steve's 911 call has never been released publicly, as we've only heard that one snippet. For all we know, Steve's remark may not seem as bad once you've heard the full context of the call. Whatever the case, it does not sound like law enforcement was overly suspicious of Steve until about a week and a half later, when a camper came forward who reported seeing a blue pickup truck which matched the description of Steve's truck speeding along Loop Road between 4:30 and 5 p.m. on the date of Amy's disappearance, and it was being driven by a man and had a blonde woman in the passenger seat. Now, we'll go into more detail about Steve's full alibi momentarily, but one thing which does seem certain is that Steve could not have been driving his truck along Loop Road during the time frame of this eyewitness sighting, because phone records showed that he made a call from his residence 15 miles away at 4:43 p.m. I'm not going to say that this camper is wrong, as it's entirely possible that she did see Amy being abducted by an entirely different man, and it's just a coincidence that they happened to drive a similar-looking truck to Steve's. But another issue is that this seems to contradict the eyewitness sighting from Jim and Wendy Gibson, who reported seeing a blonde woman matching Amy's description running along Loop Road at around 5 p.m., which would have been after the sighting from the camper took place. And I'd say that the Gibson's account is probably more credible, since they accurately described the running attire Amy would have been wearing. The Gibson said that the blonde woman was moving so quickly that she almost appeared to be running from something, but Amy was already a very speedy runner to begin with, and if she really was fleeing from someone who was attempting to harm her, I think she would have tried signaling the Gibsons for help. Anyway, it seems like Steve's most controversial decision was his refusal to take a polygraph test, which caused a lot of friction with law enforcement and Amy's family. In fact, I get the sense that the Rowe family are still bitter about Steve's decision to this day, because even if he is innocent, they believe he may have needlessly complicated the investigation by not agreeing to the polygraph. Well, I'm sure I don't have to tell you that polygraphs are not reliable, which is why they can't be used as evidence in a court of law, but people will still push forward the argument that if you're innocent and have nothing to hide, why not just take the test and clear your name for good? But the problem is that due to various factors, there's always the risk that you can fail a polygraph even if you tell the complete truth, which can only worsen your situation. Also, let's look at the context of Steve's situation, as one of the FBI agents supposedly told him, quote, I have evidence that proves you killed Amy, and we would like you to take a polygraph test right now to prove that you didn't, end quote. Well, since Steve has never been arrested, they obviously did not have the evidence that proved he killed Amy. All they really had at that time was the camper's sighting of Amy in a blue pickup truck, so it seems like the agent was trying to call Steve's bluff, but it did not work. Being accused of killing your spouse is an incredibly stressful situation, even if the allegation is completely false, and that sort of stress could cause you to register a false positive on a lie detector test. Under the circumstances, I can understand why Steve decided to stop speaking with law enforcement and hire an attorney, who apparently told Steve that he would drop him as a client if he went against his advice and took the polygraph. Keep in mind that Steve's attorney, Kent Spence, happens to be the son of Jerry Spence, a very prominent and high-profile lawyer who is renowned for having never lost a criminal case before a jury, either as a prosecutor or a defense attorney, and he has also not lost a civil case since 1969. So this obviously sounds like a family where it would be beneficial to listen to their legal advice. This is one case which only makes me wish that I am never ever in a situation where I'm asked to take a polygraph. Because even though they're unreliable, and you have every right to say no, there will always be a certain segment of the population who believe that refusing to take a polygraph is an automatic sign of guilt. So it's pretty much a no-win situation. Once Steve popped up on the radar as a possible suspect, the only so-called evidence investigators could find against him were a series of journals he had written, which supposedly contained dark fantasies about murder, violence, power, and control. Without having seen the full contents of these writings, I can't really judge how disturbing they are or how much a reflection they might be of Steve's personality, but unless he specifically wrote something about killing Amy, I'm not sure you could take this as evidence that he's a murderer. I guess the reason these journals picked up so much traction is because Amy's brother Nels and his wife Teresa claimed they noticed a bruise on Amy's arm a few weeks before she went missing, and her only response to this was that Steve could, quote-unquote, get a little rough sometimes. Now, this could be seen as a sign that Steve was violent and abusive towards Amy, but even Nels and Teresa acknowledged that Amy did not seem overly concerned when she said this, so theoretically, perhaps Steve getting a little rough sometimes could be interpreted as them engaging in some consensual sex games which might have gotten out of hand. I might be inclined to take this whole situation more seriously if there were any other reported incidents of abuse involving the couple, but it sounds like the Bechdels' friends and neighbors who lived alongside them on Climbers Row were a pretty tight-knit group, and they've always defended Steve and claimed that they never saw any signs of violence or friction within the marriage. During the time period between when Amy went missing and he got remarried to his current wife, Steve was involved in another relationship with a woman named Merritt Fisher. While their relationship ultimately didn't work out, Merritt has also publicly supported Steve and maintained there was never any abuse or threatening behavior from him during their time together. And of course, I've never heard of any issues with Steve's current marriage, which has lasted nearly 20 years and produced 2 children. Look, I'm not going to say with 100% certainty that Steve did not abuse Amy, but even if he did, that doesn't necessarily mean he's a murderer, and there also appears to be no real motive for him to harm her. It would be one thing if their marriage had been on the rocks, but the Bechdels had actually closed on the purchase of a new house only 3 days before Amy went missing, which is usually not a sign of relationship troubles. Since Amy was working at least 3 part-time jobs at the time, I get the impression that this was a split-income household, so Amy's disappearance could have caused Steve potential financial strain before he moved into his new place. Steve was also very active in the search for Amy, as he established the Amy Rowe Bechdel Recovery Headquarters and distributed hundreds of thousands of missing persons flyers, so he just doesn't give off the vibe of being a spouse who does not want his wife's body to be found. I find it interesting that in addition to a Wikipedia page about Amy's disappearance, Steve Bechdel has his own individual Wikipedia page, which goes into great detail about his rock climbing exploits, and of course, also contains a section about his potential involvement in his former wife's case. Another individual from this story who has their own personal Wikipedia page is Steve's friend and former next-door neighbor, Todd Skinner, who is also a very prominent figure in the field of rock climbing. As you recall, Todd and his own wife, Amy Whistler Skinner, were the ones who found Amy's abandoned car, and they both publicly defended Steve, maintaining that they were with him for a good chunk of that evening and saw nothing to indicate that he had done something to Amy. Tragically, in October of 2006, at the age of 43, Todd was killed during a climbing accident at the Leaning Tower at Yosemite National Park in California, and if you search online, you can even find a lengthy tribute that Steve wrote about his friend following his death. Technically, the Skinners were partial alibi witnesses for Steve on the date of Amy's disappearance, but of course, the most important alibi witness was Sam Leitner, since he supposedly spent the afternoon with Steve in Du Bois, 75 miles away. And unlike the Skinners, it does not sound like Sam was particularly fond of Steve and only kept in touch with him because of their mutual interest in rock climbing and Sam's friendship with Amy. Steve's story was that he and Sam parted ways in Du Bois sometime between 3 and 3:30 p.m. before he drove back to Lander, and there is a record of a phone call from the Bechdel residence placing Steve there at 4:43. Investigators confirmed that there was a gas station receipt placing Sam in Du Bois on July the 24th, but seemed to put a lot of emphasis on the fact that there was no paper trail or any other independent eyewitnesses who could place Steve there. I mean, since Steve and Sam claimed they were scouting rock climbing locations in a remote area, the lack of eyewitness sightings does not seem like a big deal. But if Steve did kill Amy that day, the only way this scenario works is if Sam intentionally lied to the police in order to fabricate a false alibi for Steve, even though Sam said he did not particularly like Steve all that much, and certainly wouldn't have helped him cover up the murder of a close friend like Amy. Even so, it was confirmed that Amy paid a visit to the Gallery 331 photo store at 2:30 p.m., which still only leaves Steve just over 2 hours to kill Amy, abandon her car at Burnt Gulch, dispose of her body, and then drive 15 miles back home to make the 4:43 phone call. That scenario isn't impossible, but you would think this tight time frame might have caused Steve to make some mistakes and leave more evidence behind. Of course, an alternate possibility is that Steve could have killed Amy sometime after he arrived in Lander at 4:30, but the issue is that he interacted with quite a few people over the course of the evening. To recap, we know that a friend stopped by to invite Steve out for pizza at 6:45, Steve went to hang out with the Skinners at 8:15, he phoned Amy's parents at 9 o'clock to check if she was there, phoned the police at 10:30 to report her missing, met up with the Skinners when they returned home at 11 o'clock, and the Skinners then found Amy's abandoned car at 1 a.m. Yes, I suppose there are a few gaps throughout the evening in which Steve's whereabouts are unaccounted for, but none of these gaps offer much of a time frame for Steve to kill Amy, make the 15-mile trip to Burnt Gulch, dispose of Amy's body in such a thorough fashion that it has not been found in 26 years, and then return home. In addition, the only way this scenario works is if Amy and Steve both drove their respective vehicles to Burnt Gulch, because if Amy's car was abandoned there, Steve still needs another vehicle to drive back home. I know that after Steve's truck was impounded and processed, Dave King told the media that they found some quote-unquote questionable substance, which he described as quote-unquote biological things, but since we have heard no further details about this so-called evidence, I'm inclined to think that it's a whole load of nothing. Unless they specifically found blood evidence, then it doesn't really mean much if Amy's DNA, hair, or fiber evidence was inside Steve's truck, because as his wife, I'm sure she would have been in there on multiple occasions. Also, when breaking down Steve's alibi, you also have to take the eyewitness sighting from the Gibsons into account, as they believe they saw Amy running down Loop Road at around 5 p.m., which is after Steve already arrived home. If their sighting is accurate, and Amy was still alive at 5 o'clock, then all this discussion about Steve lying about his trip to Du Bois and fabricating an alibi is completely irrelevant. On a side note, one detail which often gets overlooked about this case is that Steve took his dog John's with him on his trip to Du Bois. Steve once said that this was his biggest regret, as he believes that if he had left the dog at home, Amy may have taken John's with her for her run at Burnt Gulch. And if she was the victim of foul play, the perpetrator may have been more reluctant to go after her if she had her dog as protection. Look, you can speculate all you want about Steve being a jerk or a terrible, abusive husband, but none of that stuff even matters if the timeline makes it physically impossible for Steve to have committed this crime. I agree with Kent Spence's statement that investigators may have become so frustrated by the lack of leads and evidence that they started placing all their focus on Steve and developed tunnel vision. When Dave King was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, he kind of rubbed me the wrong way when he discussed Steve's potential involvement and said, quote, "Statistically, he did it." I mean, yes, statistics do show that a woman is more likely to be killed by her spouse or someone she knows rather than some random killer, but you have to go where the evidence takes you, and I see nothing to indicate that it leads to Steve Bechtel. It does not sound like Amy told anyone of her plans to go running on Loop Road that afternoon, but judging from the writings on her to-do list, it seems likely that she went there in order to scout and practice the course for her upcoming 10K run. Assuming that the blonde runner the Gibsons saw was Amy, they did not see her when they drove back down Loop Road in the opposite direction later that evening, though it sounds like they passed by Amy's Toyota Tercel. So this implies that something happened to Amy during this time frame. The most common theory is that Amy crossed paths with someone in that area who murdered her, but I suppose we can't completely discount the possibility that she became lost in the woods and got injured or died of exposure, or that she was attacked and killed by a wild animal. It sounds like law enforcement have all but discounted this possibility because the search effort was very extensive, and since Lander is surrounded by wilderness and it's so easy to get lost there, the area search and rescue teams are considered to be more thorough and well-trained than average. But like I mentioned on this podcast numerous times, even the best search efforts can fail to find missing victims, and we've seen so many examples of human remains being discovered years after the fact in an area which was already thoroughly searched. The only potential evidence which turned up was a Timex Iron Man digital wristwatch, which was not found until 2003. It was the same type of watch Amy would have been wearing, and while it could not be conclusively established that it belonged to her, it is a bit odd that this one particular item would be found, but nothing else. I guess my main issue with the idea of Amy getting lost is that she was seen running down Loop Road, and while I don't know many specific details of the course of this 10K run, would it have required her to veer off in different directions? If this course only required Amy to head in one direction and stay on the main road, then it should have been easy for her to make her way back to her car. One detail which has always struck people as unusual is that even though Amy's wallet was missing, her keys were still inside her vehicle, which was left unlocked. This could be seen as a sign that Amy was forcibly abducted from that spot, but an alternate explanation is that she may have intentionally left her keys in the car because it would have been inconvenient and illogical for her to carry them around in her shorts while she was running, as there was always a risk of the keys falling out and her losing them. I mean, this was a remote area in the middle of nowhere, and Lander was not exactly known for being a high crime area, so Amy may have felt there was no harm in leaving her keys inside her car, because what are the odds of someone happening upon her vehicle and stealing it? But then again, what are the odds of Amy crossing paths with someone at this remote spot who wound up killing her? I know there have always been rumors throughout the area that Amy may have been the victim of a hit and run, and the most prevalent theory is that it involved a group of Native Americans from a nearby reservation who were driving drunk that day and struck her before disposing of her body. Unfortunately, very few details have been released about this theory, but law enforcement have investigated it and found no evidence to support the idea that these rumors are true. I do often see hit-and-run scenarios get pushed forward as a theory in unsolved missing persons cases, but I'd be curious to know how many documented examples there are of motorists hitting an innocent person and transporting their body away from the scene in order to dispose of it. Yes, there are a few cases where this sort of thing likely did happen, such as the disappearance of Erica Baker, which I covered on episode number 201 of this podcast. But it seems to me that if you ever commit a hit and run, it would be far less risky to just drive away from the scene as quickly as possible before anyone sees you, rather than going to the trouble of loading the victim's body into your vehicle and taking it away from the scene. If Amy was the victim of foul play, I'm more inclined to believe it was an abduction and murder rather than an accidental hit and run. So now we have to talk about Dale Wayne Eaton, as other than Steve Bechtel, he has been pushed forward as the most likely suspect to have killed Amy. He definitely seems like a promising candidate, but there is really no evidence against him, other than his brother's claim that Eaton was allegedly camping near Burnt Gulch on the date Amy went missing. Richard Eaton originally submitted this tip to the authorities back in 1998, but they pretty much ignored it until John Zerga became lead investigator over a decade later. The original investigators apparently seemed to believe that Dale was staying with his niece in Colorado on the day Amy went missing, and they also may have believed that Richard was simply trying to cash in on a $100,000 reward which was being offered at that time. But Richard did seem to have an intimate knowledge of the Burnt Gulch area to suggest that his brother had gone camping there, so this could very well be a case of Amy being in the wrong place at the wrong time and crossing paths with a murderer. Now, Eaton is currently incarcerated for the murder of Lisa Marie Kimmel, and the details of what he did to her are so horrific that you hope the same thing did not happen to Amy. If you go to the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always referencing, you'll find a number of older posts there from Lisa's mother, Sheila Kimmel, who published a book about her daughter's case titled The Murder of Lil Miss. Sheila seems convinced that Eaton was also responsible for the disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel, and if so, then it's crazy to think that the same perpetrator may have killed two separate victims from two seemingly unrelated cases, which were each featured on Unsolved Mysteries a decade apart. I also previously made mention of a series of crimes known as the Great Basin Murders, which involved 9 young women being killed in 4 different states between 1983 and 1997. I won't go into too many details about these cases, since I may cover this topic on a future podcast episode, but Lisa Marie Kimmel was originally classified as one of the Great Basin victims, and for years, it was suspected that all the crimes were committed by a serial killer. But 4 of these 9 cases, including Lisa's murder, have been solved, and each of them were linked to a different perpetrator. So it's possible that all these crimes are completely unrelated, but I don't discount the idea that Eaton could have been responsible for some of the murders which are still unsolved. It's worth noting that the first Great Basin murder, involving a 23-year-old victim named Janelle Johnson, actually took place in Fremont County in March of 1983. And the last of these victims, an 18-year-old sex worker named Tanya Teske, was found in Yukon, Idaho on August the 15th, 1997, 3 weeks after Amy went missing, and only 1 month before Eaton was arrested for the attempted kidnapping of the Breeden family. And, well, after Eaton's arrest, the Great Basin murders seemed to come to a stop. However, what separates these crimes from the Amy Rowe Bechtel case is that the victims' bodies were all found, whereas Amy was not. What's particularly unusual about the murder of Lisa Marie Kimmel is that it might be the only case I can think of where the perpetrator dumped the victim's body out in the open, yet went to the trouble of burying the victim's vehicle on their property. If Eaton had done the same thing with Lisa's body, then her case might never have been solved, since the only reason her murder was linked to Eaton was because of DNA testing. The circumstances of this case seem to be the polar opposite of what happened to Amy Rowe Bechtel, so if Eaton was responsible, would he have bothered to dispose of Amy's body? Well, he obviously wouldn't have known about DNA evidence back in 1988, but I guess it's possible that by 1997, Eaton had become aware that DNA was being used to solve cold cases, so he became more cautious and took extra steps to cover up what he did to Amy. Now, when Eaton attempted to kidnap the Breeden family in September of 1997, he was driving a green 1985 Dodge van, and here's another interesting eyewitness sighting from Amy's case, which I haven't mentioned yet. A mechanic named Earl Osborne reported driving past a blonde woman matching Amy's description running on Loop Road on the day she went missing, and he said she waved at him. When Osborne drove back down the road in the opposite direction a short time later, he claimed he did not see the woman, but noticed what he described as an old blue-green vehicle, which may have been a van, and it was stopped in the road. On the surface, this possible sighting of the van could be a piece of evidence which places Eaton in the area that day, but here's the problem. Osborne said that he drove past the woman at 10:30 a.m. As you recall, the Gibsons reported seeing Amy on Loop Road at 5 p.m., and we know that she was seen at the Gallery 331 camera store at 2:30. I mean, I guess it's possible that Amy could have taken an earlier trip to Loop Road to go running before she returned later that day, but as far as I know, she should have been teaching her weightlifting class at the fitness center at 10:30 a.m. So it's possible that Osborne has some details wrong about this sighting. And of course, there's also the issue of the camper who thought she saw Amy in a blue pickup truck around the same time period when the Gibsons saw her running on Loop Road. Well, to be honest, I have no idea which of these sightings, if any of them, are accurate, and this was an issue which complicated the investigation into Lisa Marie Kimmel's murder. If you go back and watch the original Unsolved Mysteries segment about that case, they put a lot of emphasis on a number of eyewitness sightings of Lisa, which supposedly took place after she went missing. But since the witnesses specifically described her driving a car with the distinct Lil Miss Vanity license plate, their sightings seem pretty believable on the surface, but of course, we all know that these people had to be wrong, since Lisa had already been abducted by Eaton at that point. I don't think any of the witnesses were lying, as I'm sure they genuinely thought they were being helpful, but they obviously must have been mistaken about certain details, such as the date their sightings took place. So who's to say that many, if not all, of the witnesses who thought they saw Amy couldn't have been mistaken as well? Whatever the case, I am inclined to believe that Amy was the victim of foul play, and I also think she was likely abducted and taken away from the burnt gulch area in a vehicle before she was murdered, which is why the extensive search effort through Shoshone National Forest failed to turn up any evidence. But if this is what happened, could Dale Wayne Eaton be the perpetrator? Well, even though Eaton is going to remain incarcerated for the rest of his life, he has always refused to be interviewed about this case by law enforcement. He's got nothing left to lose at this point, but convicted murderers sometimes relish the power that comes with intentionally withholding information about other crimes they committed after they've been sent to prison. Given Eaton's advanced age, it's been reported that his mental health has declined in recent years, so time is running out to link him to Amy's disappearance. While I've seen a number of unsolved cases involving missing and murdered women, where it seemed obvious the husband was responsible, I don't believe this is one of them. I still think that the original investigators got tunnel vision and spent too much time focusing on Steve Bechtel, even though the timeline could have made it really difficult, if not outright impossible, for him to have done this. If Amy's case is solved and winds up being linked to another suspect, then I hope this finally offers some vindication for Steve and also some peace for the Rowe family. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Amy Rowe Bechtel, please contact the Fremont County Sheriff's Office at 307-332-5611. That's 307-332-5611. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a Halloween-themed bonus episode about the Guardian UFO case, which explores the odd 1991 sighting of a mysterious object in a field just outside my hometown of Ottawa, Ontario. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another Halloween-themed mystery, the unexplained 1988 death of David Stone. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and that's Courtney P. and Carol. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.